Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Hello, all. Welcome to another episode of Armchair Cricket Podcast, a podcast focusing on test cricket by armchair critics of the game. I'm your host, Ajit. Today, we have a much sought-after returning guest. Hello, SP. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Ajit. Good morning to you and good evening from my side. It's a pleasure to be back having a chat with you after such a long time. So thanks for having me.
No worries. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. And I hope you had a nice day. I'm only halfway through my day. This is my lunch break, right? Let's hope my bosses are not hearing this.
Yeah, don't worry. I won't dob you in.
Oh, perfect. If we go back to the test series, the second test, between Sri Lanka and Ireland. This was the last one. Our previous episode, they were through the first day, I think. And Ireland had made a very positive start. We were really hoping they cross 450, make it really tough for Sri Lanka. So my guest then had opined, in spite of however well they bat in the first innings, Sri Lanka will come up with enough of a performance to kill the match. That's exactly what they've done. Well, in the process, they've broken a record for Irish people. You realize which one that is?
Yes, I do. And I think it's not a record Ireland would want to be proud of, because I think if my memory serves me right, the previous holder of that record was England. You know, in that Karun Nair test match, England scored 470 something. And 477. And then India made 700 and plus. And then, just as you thought, okay, maybe this match is heading towards another draw, because it was more or less a lifeless chipok pitch. And then England just crumbled and India won by an innings and God knows how many runs on top of that. So, like I said, it's not a record Ireland would be proud of, especially snatching it from England.
Exactly. So now Ireland have hold the record. So they made 492 in the first innings, thanks to 280 and another 95. So a lot of really good scores. I mean, 492 is nothing to be sneezed at, no matter where you are, no matter which part of the world. But Sri Lanka, when they come out to bat, they had a clear mandate, right? So they wanted to bat once, bat big, that sort of stuff. So there were two double hundreds and two other hundreds. So, and they were scoring at, I think, comfortably 4.5 runs an over plus. Does this surprise you at all?
I think, if you take into account the fact that the first test match was played at Galle as well, and, Sri Lanka scored massively in that first innings, they scored something almost close to 600 runs. So I think Sri Lanka batting and piling on the runs on that ground is not surprising at all. What I felt a little bit happy about was the fact that even though during the first 3-4 days, the pitch was really flat and wasn't really assisting the spinners, Ireland managed to post that big a score in the first innings. And I think that speaks volumes about how much they had improved and adapted until their nemesis spin bowling came to undo them in that on the fifth day. So, you know, this Sri Lankan performance reminded me a lot about, you know, when in the late 90s, early 2000s, Jayasurya, Attapattu, Mahanama, Sangakkara, Jayawardene in the middle order. These guys were just racking up centuries after centuries. And then Sri Lanka on the fifth day would get Murli out and, you know, the opposition would just crumble. So it wasn't really that astonishing that Sri Lanka piled on such a massive mammoth total.
Well, it was a Jayasurya in this case, but Jayasurya with the ball. So yeah. Prabhat Jayasurya, he took
the ball, yeah.
Right? He took a 7-4, but I mean, he's taking wickets with a bucket full. He's played mostly at home and he's been like ridiculously successful. But well, going back to those innings, I think before this Sri Lanka batting innings, I remember tweeting, Matthews is due a few runs. It's sort of, you know, fill your bucket time, I suppose. But they all got out there. Kusal Mendes made a double hundred. Nishan Madhuska, who's like, he's a good keeper, but also I think in this game, he was playing only as an opener. He made a double hundred, right? And Karunaratne basically started it off all. I mean, making a hundred.
Yeah.
Again, does it really surprise you at all that Ireland were unable to get out of it? Was it sort of on course for you?
You know, like Ramchandra mentioned in your earlier podcast as well, that, you know, Sri Lanka is basically a very tough team to beat at home. And, you know, there's always a possibility that they will come out and, you know, snatch that victory. I had hoped that given the first innings performance and the fact that not a lot had changed, you know, with regards to the pitch, Ireland could have managed to survive the last day, but they do struggle against spin. And the telling difference was not so much Prabhat Jayasurya, but it was Ramesh Mendes. Because, you know, there is a big difference in his economy rate in the first innings versus the second innings. So, you know, he bowled a similar number of overs, but he went for over 100 runs in the first innings and I think took only one or two wickets. But in the second innings, you know, he took 5 wickets for almost half the tally of runs within the same number of like overs or balls that he bowled.
Right.
And I think that was where the big difference was. Because if you see, you know, Prabhat Jayasurya's accuracy, because I watched him play against Australia in his debut series as well, and he was very accurate, like coming around the wicket or even over the wicket. And, you know, he had the Australian batters in a completely, you know, spin, so to speak. And then I think he did something similar against Pakistan as well. So Ireland hardly stood a chance against him. But rather than him being the tormentor-in-chief in the second innings, it was Ramesh Mendes. And I think it might have been, you know, mostly to do with the fact that, you know, they are very different sort of bowlers in a way.
Also, I think Asita Fernando.
But, yeah.
That spell, right? Asita Fernando. I think he did pretty well as well.
Oh, yeah.
Fast bowler.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, because he got three. He got three, didn't he?
They'll just have to consider themselves really unlucky here. You don't often lose a test if you make nearly 700 runs in it. Just that they ran into somebody.
Very, very rarely.
They ran into somebody who was, you know, determined. And of course, they were playing at home. Yeah. And at least for Ireland, over the last two series that they have played, there's a lot of, really lot of positives that they can take away. The results are not falling on their way, but at least you can be sure they can be proud of the way they have come up with the runs and they've piled up hundreds.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you look at this, right? The last test, like before this Sri Lanka series, Ireland played against Bangladesh, but that was just a one-off test. And if you look throughout their series in Bangladesh, including the T20s and the one days, you know, their performances were incrementally getting better because, you know, they don't get these sort of conditions in Ireland and England. Most of their players have not even played on these conditions. Generally, when Ireland play T20s or ODIs, you know, they more or less get batting friendly tracks as well. So to be able to acclimatize to the subcontinental conditions over a five-day test match, and it takes a lot of preparation, which they haven't had. Before the Bangladesh test, their last test match was against England in, what, 2019?
Yes, exactly. No, 2019. Earlier, where they were bundled out for 35 in the 4 weeks.
Yeah. 2019, yeah. Yeah, but don't forget, they also bundled out England for 85 in the first innings at Lord's.
Absolutely. Yeah, that game.
Yeah. So, you know, I think when it comes to swing and seam friendly bowling conditions, they might be able to put up a better fight. They're not used to playing that much spin. A lot of their players play in the county leagues as well, where again, spin is hardly seen, like especially quality spin, like you'd get in Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, India, for example. So, you know, I think with more exposure, more practice, you know, they can only improve. You know, like last year when England went to Netherlands and just smashed them every single game, as the games progressed, Netherlands actually got better and better and better. And then we saw what their performance was like in the T20 World Cup in Australia. So they actually put up, you know, good fights against some of the established team, beat South Africa. So I think it's the same thing with Ireland. And I hope that, you know, other countries, like forget the big three, but countries like Ireland, Afghanistan, Zimbabwe, West Indies, you know, to a certain extent, maybe even Sri Lanka and New Zealand can pool their resources and start playing each other on a regular basis, both home and away. And this will only just help improve their game. And this way we get more test matches too.
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's been mooted. I think ICC might even be considering it a two-tier league, where, you know, so that there is an independent promotion demotion sort of happening every 2 years. You can have the ICC World Test Championship with two tiers, and let's say one team gets demoted and one team that wins all the games, or one team that wins the lower league gets promoted. So that'll give
absolutely
a little bit more lease of life. So if I were to put it like that, to test cricket.
And you know, there are and there are many people who have been asking for this for many years now. And if you look at it, you know, ICC has done the right thing in granting everybody T20 status. I mean, firstly, I don't agree with this concept of status to begin with, because if there is a format, let people play the format, and then, you know, you just have like a global ranking or a ladder, or just divide them into leagues, which is what, you know, used to happen, because you had your full member status, and then you had your associates and affiliates, and then I think there were five divisions as such. And then every time you did well in that particular division, you got promoted into the next division. So you went into division four, then three, then two, and then I think you got your associate status. And then, you know, obviously, assuming that you have fulfilled certain requirements and your performances on the field are up to scratch, you know, you got full member status, or you got test status, however the case may be. So I think that is something that definitely we could look forward to. You know, this phase that we are in now, it seems as if this is a very crucial phase where cricket administrators are just about realizing how important it is to grow the game and how much money the sport can make, and by extension, each individual board or association. So, yeah, good things might happen. Who knows?
Absolutely. Look, I've heard a lot of talk that Test cricket is on the way out and so on, but it's managed to stick around for 140 years. I think it'll just continue to reinvent.
Absolutely.
We do have to concede that the number of teams that might end up playing test matches will probably reduce. But it'll finally, I think, 15 teams, so it might sort of stick to that, and it might survive that way or even thrive from then on.
Well, you know, you never know. I think a lot of it depends upon the context of the match, right? Mm. So at the moment, because we have some specific rivalries, such as England, Australia, you have your Ashes, you have India, Pakistan, which hasn't happened for many years now. Mm. Now you have India, England, India, Australia, you have got New Zealand, Australia. There are all these rivalries that actually bring people to the cricket grounds, and you get equal number of eyeballs watching the game on the TV as well. Mm. But let's say, for example, in 15 years' time, you know, you have Brazil and Argentina playing.
Right.
I mean, they are rivals in their own context, isn't it? Whether it's football or volleyball or any other sport, even hockey for that matter. So, you know, people sort of do get attuned to that. And, you know, combined, I don't know what the exact populations are like, but Brazil and Argentina do command a significant percentage of the population in South America. And, you know, some enterprising executive at a TV channel might say, yeah, we want rights to test cricket between these two countries. And once it is available and people are aware of that sport and the fact that, yeah, our two teams are clashing it out on the ground, people automatically come and follow these things. And then you have, you know, people like me who will just watch any cricket match for that matter.
Absolutely. Look, at least for us, we are sort of fans, and we are happy that more quality cricket we get to watch, the happier we'll be. And then, I mean, we would like it, at least for me, I would love it to be the best, the highest quality, but it's not always possible. And it's not always the highest level, at least as most people would consider it, test matches. But I'm happy and I'll take as many test matches as I get. So the more the better.
I agree 100%. Yeah. Right. I mean, just to put into context, look at Ireland. When Ireland first came onto the scene, they had only what, two or three players that you could say people were aware of. You had Porterfield, you had Kevin O'Brien, mm-hmm. and maybe Ed Joyce and Johnston later on. You know?
Correct.
But now you've got Paul Sterling, Andy Balbirnie, you've got your Harry Tector, you've got your Lorcan Tucker, mm-hmm. you've got Curtis Camphor, you've got that fast bowler, long, can't remember his first name.
Little, now. Is it? Josh Little?
And Josh Little, thank you. Yeah. Not long, sorry. Yeah. Josh Little. Yeah, that's the one. Right? And, you know, it's these guys are still young. I mean, Andy Balbirnie and Paul Sterling, these are like the elder statesmen of that team, but they're only 32 years old. Mm-hmm. They can easily play for another 3 or 4 years, during which time the youngsters can be mentored very well. And with the exposure that they get playing county cricket as well, you know, they're just developing facets of their game. I mean, it's a no-brainer, to be honest. They just need a good deal of investment and regular games. That's all they need.
I mean, you have to be a bit careful because now there might be a bit of clashes with people getting, you know, also a bit interested in playing the leagues. For example, like Little actually prioritizing playing in the IPL ahead of playing test matches for Ireland.
Yeah.
But you would expect they'll have to find to coexist with that. Probably even as their development happens, they'll find it easier to already understand and, you know, accommodate these sort of things. For example, New Zealand is playing in Pakistan right now, and 4 or 5 of their first choice players are already in IPL. So if you were to quickly switch to that series, New Zealand did really well to hold Pakistan 2-2 in the T20A series. But so far,
absolutely.
One-way traffic, ODIs, 2 ODIs, 2 losses for New Zealand.
Yeah, but even then, you can see that story. Like, you know, I don't know how long it has been since New Zealand has toured Pakistan. But if you start with the first T20, New Zealand were bundled for under 100.
Right.
Then the second one, they made a few more runs. Then they made a few more runs. Mm. And then they were pretty much consistently pushing 200 in the T20s. One-day matches, I think the first match they made something like 270, 280. And then, but after that, they crossed 300. So, and you'd kind of think that 300 would be par on something like a flat deck in Pakistan for a one-day game.
Correct.
And, you know, they have been putting up the fight and the effort. And like you said, you know, if they had their first choice team, they probably could have, you know, really given Pakistan a real tough fight. And they might have been leading in one of the series as well. And let's not forget that, you know, for us, we think of bilateral series as something really important, like you have to win it. I think there has been a very definite shift in the mentality of the teams, though, and the country's particular cricket board or association or coaching setup, because they see bilateral series now as basically a preparation ground to bring in youngsters, freshen the new blood, and basically just test out team compositions, batting positions. And look at Daryl Mitchell. You know, this guy has always played what, lower middle order, and now suddenly he's batting at 3 and he's hammered out 200s in these 2 one-day games.
Exactly. I mean, that was the other guy, right? So he made 200s. Just that Fakhar Zaman outmatched him with 200s of his own. And playing in the Asian subcontinent, you expect around 300 to be like more or less par score, right? With
pretty much par score, yeah.
So I think first game, they were good, but to make 288, as you said, they're learning. They're getting better as they go on. I was a bit disappointed with Tom Latham's innings in both the games. But I mean, that's sometimes bound to happen. He was the skipper in this series. So Will Young, who's the opener, sort of did well in the first game, right? If you're a Pakistan bowling attack, I think you'll be a little bit worried about your leading bowlers, Haris Rauf, Shaheen Shah Afridi, taking a bit of tap. But Naseem Shah came good, right? So Naseem Shah's performance is really...
Naseem Shah has been very... Yeah, he's been very, very exciting. You know, like that. I don't know if you watched his debut match against Australia in Australia when Pakistan toured here a few years ago. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago.
I can't remember it, but I was looking forward to it, I remember, as somebody really fast, right? Young and
fast. Yeah, he was absolutely raw, an absolute tearaway. And I think he was only about 17, 18 years old at that time. But he lacked that control, that rhythm that you need in test matches, you know, where you have to be a bit patient and plan for your wickets. And I think as he has gathered that experience over the last 2 to 3 years, you know, we can finally see what his true potential looks like.
Absolutely.
And look, let's be honest, Pakistan has always produced, you know, a long list of talented fast bowlers. More often than not, their fast bowlers have lost out because of selection politics, board politics, and God knows what else. So, you know, it's like this, you know, mystical way of selecting players that they have. They'll pick up somebody who is absolutely, you know, unexposed at that high level at 16, 17, just on the basis of talent and potential. And then they have also benched people who are pretty much, you know, in the middle of a good run of form and are proven performers. So, you know, it's very difficult to say how they think and the way they plan these things. But just coming back to New Zealand's position earlier, I think given the fact that the World Cup is now in the subcontinent, this is a really good preparation for them. So even if some of their players are still plying their trade in the IPL, they're still getting valuable intel about the ground conditions, the pitches, you know, is there, well, I think the dew factor will come in later on in October, because this time of the year, you don't get a lot of dew.
Right.
But, you know, it's just generally how the pitches play out. So it's not like they're losing on any valuable contribution from these players who are not actively involved in the Pakistan series. That's just my view on that.
Interesting, because for me, they're also trying out some of their, you know, what you would call A-team players or the next cabs of the rank. When it comes to Pakistan, there's Ehsanullah, there's Usama Mir, Agha Salman, all of these people getting regular games, right? Abdullah Shafiq, for example, in the limited
overs. Yeah, absolutely.
And the other thing they have done, they have finally figured out, you know, as good as Babar Azam and Mohammad Rizwan are, they are probably better utilized in a more, you know, because it's an ODI, they are better utilized in a more holding sort of a role. Babar Azam bats at 3. I think that's been his role right through. Mohammad Rizwan bats at 5. And that experience helps. So in the second game, really, Fakhar Zaman played one of the best knocks I've seen in a chase, 180. So that's quite something. But otherwise, it was also 50 from Rizwan and Azam, which sort of set them up nicely, right? So they never looked like they were going to lose that game, in spite of required run rate being about 7, almost right through. They never looked in any trouble. So that augurs really well for Pakistan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in that case, you could say that it was Fakhar Zaman who anchored that particular innings, because not only did he play at a fast clip, he made sure that he didn't get out. Because oftentimes what you see is when batters try to maintain that fast pace of scoring, they're more prone to taking a few risks in the middle overs. And then when you lose wicket, what happens is the new batter then has to adjust first and then sort of keep up with the scoring rate, by which time you have lost enough deliveries that the asking run rate can climb very steeply. Then that adds more pressure on the batters down the order to sort of keep up with that. And if you look at coming in and whacking from the first ball, it's very difficult to do that in the ODI because, you know, even though the number of overs are fewer, you still have 10 wickets. Mm. So, you know, you can easily have a team all out in less than 20 overs and just basically come up with next to nothing. But in a one day, you have to maintain those 10 wickets over 50 overs. So maintaining wickets becomes equally important. And I think that is where Pakistan, you know, benefited, because with Fakhar not only maintaining his wicket, but also scoring at a fast clip, I think it helped players like Babar and Rizwan down the order sort of maintain that scoring rate. So I don't think they ever felt that the target was beyond their reach, because, you know, they won with, what, 10 balls to spare.
They just took it very comfortably. The chase didn't really bother them.
Yeah,
much, right?
Exactly. Point that as for Rizwan batting at 5, when Rizwan first came into the Pakistani team, he didn't start as an opener. He started as a keeper who batted in that lower middle order. And because he had this talent and proclivity to hit boundaries and even some of the big shots for 6, I think they tried bumping him up to an opener's role to accelerate right at the top. But unfortunately, what happened was, because it was him and Babar in the T20 squad, I think their roles, the instructions they were given was, look, we don't have anyone else playing after you guys get out. So just hang in there, even if the scoring rate is a little bit lower.
Mm.
And I think now that he's back into familiar territory at five, he knows exactly what he needs to do. With experience, he has gained that confidence that not only can he hold that anchor role, but also sort of accelerate at the end like a finisher.
Indeed. Now that makes sense. That that experience is there. I think he played a definitive hand in both the games with the finish. And that's good. That's good that he can always provide those. You know, he has the experience to actually sort of change. If you are setting up a total, he can give you a bit more stability. But if you're chasing a total, he can go after the ball. So I think he did well.
Yeah, yeah.
And basically, Fakhar Zaman is again given a clear, you know, clear indication that he should just be opening. I mean, every format of the game he gets to play.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I mean, it's a no-brainer for this guy. You know, the first tournament that I noticed Fakhar Zaman was the 2017 Champions Trophy.
Indeed, that final,
and
right?
He scored another. Yeah, that final. I thought, oh my God, like why has Pakistan kept this guy under wraps? And since then, I think it basically should have been an automatic decision that this guy just opens. There's no point, you know, sending him down the order. He should be there opener, whether it's T20s or one days, because he's a very talented, gifted stroke maker. You know, hitting those shots comes very easy to him. He's also very pleasing on the eye as well.
Hmm. He's a natural striker of the ball, no doubt. I think their plans are sort of taking good shape, given that this is the World Cup year. And the World Cup will be held in the subcontinent. So, some interesting days ahead if you're a Pakistani cricket fan.
No, I think with Pakistani cricket fan, there's always interesting days ahead because you never know how they perform.
Your games are always interesting. Let's put it like this. Your days will always be interesting. Sometimes on the field, sometimes off the field as well, right? So there'll always be some news.
True.
Some news. All right.
Yeah.
Those were the, let's say, the live games that we want to talk in the international level. But coming to the domestic level, IPL. Well, what's happening, SP? It looks like suddenly 200 was not enough over the weekend. Now, over the last 2 days, 125, 130 is enough?
I know. It's very lopsided in the sense that you don't have that middle ground of scores, you know, from the 140 to the 180s. Either, depending on which ground you're playing at, you have teams have scored below 140 or 200 and above.
Right. So it's very interesting that you were mentioning off air. This tournament has already had the most 200 plus scores in an IPL. And if you're playing in Wankhede, if you're playing in Chinnaswamy, you know, places, even Chennai potentially, they will still come. Those big scores will still come. Those pitches don't seem to be tiring out.
They're still coming.
What you expect, the pitches will sort of tire out a little because it's a home and away format. So at best, you'll have three or four strips that they can use, right? So eventually those pitches sort of tire out. You'll get those 150, 160 scores, which are then becoming good defendable scores. Not yet. But then if you head away from right? If you go to Lucknow, if you go to Ahmedabad, or
I know,
they're always, so even Hyderabad, they're always putting up low scores. Right.
So, low scores,
And
that's partly because the bounce on those pitches is generally lower than Wankhede, Chinnaswamy, or the Chepauk. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you generally have to play with more attention that you don't, you know, start hoiking at balls that staying low or are coming off slower once they pitch.
So, in that case, you know, probably teams already will readjust the moment they start with the batting. I think I remember in one game, KL Rahul talking to his partner and saying, you know, looking at this pitch, 150 looks like a good total. You don't have to go break the bank, try to score 200, make 150. This is enough. And they did defend this. This is earlier in the tournament, I remember, right? So, and Gujarat Titans once defended 135 on the same Lucknow pitch. So, anyway, speaking of Rahul, his injury.
But the same Gujarat Titans,
sorry,
just to say that the same Gujarat Titans recently lost against Delhi. Chasing 130 something, wasn't it?
Exactly. So
and that's at Ahmedabad. So it's not even Lucknow.
So I think that was like good bowling from Delhi, by the way. So first of all, from 25 for 5 or
for a change.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you think the game is sunk. I remember tweeting saying the game is sunk. They're 25 for 5. There's not a lot else left, right? 5 for 23 even. So, but then Aman Hakim Khan, He made a beautiful 50. Akshar Patel made some runs. Dipal Patel made some runs. So 130, in the end, you still think this is nothing. They'll chase it down in 14 hours or whatever, right? But what really changed the game is the spell from Khalil Ahmed and the Ishan Sharma right at the top. So first of all, Norgay took out Gill. That helped. But then they kept Hardik Pandya tied down, right? He couldn't get free. And with his experience, you think he'll take a dip, which he did, right? So they also reduced Gujarat Titans to 4 for 32. And then Abhinav Manohar and Hardik Pandya, both of whom are big hitters, they took their time knowing that runs will come. And once at some point in time, they'll get some free hand. That's where you should give all the credit, because Kuldeep Yadav and Akshar Patel bowled fantastically in the middle overs, right?
Yeah.
And in the end, it was actually very tough. You didn't see how Gujarat Titans would win it. Then comes this twist in the tail with Rahul Tevatiya, as always. Three sixes, hat-trick sixes against Norkia, right? Then suddenly it's 12-6, right? And then 12-6 in an IPL game, especially with some strikers of the ball, like Rahul Tevatiya still at the crease. You think this is going to be a walkover, right? Pandya and Tevatiya. So you think first or second ball of the over will go for a six, and that's that. Who's bowling the over? Again, a very storied veteran. Ishan Sharma. So what happened there?
Well, what happened there, I think, is basically there for everybody to see what happened there. And this is not the first time Ishant has done something like this. I mean, despite the fact that I still think you have to force Ishant to get into that zone where he bowls that way. And I mean, let's not forget the fact that after that wicket where Tevatiya got out, there was a drop catch the very next ball as well.
Absolutely. Otherwise, probably it would have gotten even more tough, let's just say. So he was particularly unhittable, I suppose. So in that last over, he bowled a lot of knuckleballs. And I think he had a plan for the likes of Tevatiya, who likes to swing the ball across. I mean, I think one of the sixes he hit of Norkia was an unbelievable shot, because it was on the fifth stump outside off. He just swung it across all the way for a comfortable six. So they had planned something for him to bowl outside his comfort zone.
Yeah, and to hit sixes like that, you need some assistance from the bowler in terms of pace. Nokia brings that pace, whereas the delivery that got Tevatiya out was a very slower ball from Ishant, which I think he bowled very cleverly, knowing that, you know, if he holds back the pace on that delivery, Tevatiya is likely to just sky it or make some sort of mistake.
Which is precisely
I'm fairly certain that... Yeah, whereas I'm fairly certain that if Ishant had bowled at his regular pace of around mid-130s, that thing would have gone for a boundary as well.
Correct. So I think he was very clever in the way he bowled, the way he delivered those deliveries. But, you know, Ishant Sharma, we have some horror stories in our mind.
I have horror stories, and I still think that this guy cannot bowl four overs without conceding at least one no ball or something.
Not just that. I mean, who is the Australian left-handed all-rounder, fast bowling all-rounder? He doesn't get to play much in Australia now. I'll tell you, his name will come. He hit a lot of boundaries of Ishant, one ODI series, like consecutive games. I remember this is like
Faulkner.
James Faulkner, exactly.
Faulkner.
Right?
Yeah.
So you would think something like that, but then he's come back and come back how? He's there. He's not only holding back the runs, but also, you know, actually this game, they needed 5 out of 5 bowlers to get it right, which they did.
Yeah. So, and look, I'll admit this. I'm not a big... Look, when Ishant Sharma first started, I had high hopes. Then when I watched him bowl the same sort of deliveries day in, day out, and, you know, sort of give easy runs and bowl those no balls, I lost that hope. And now you can see that over the last 2, maybe 3 years, he has actually improved significantly, not just when he bowls in India, but when he bowls overseas as well. And he's now like this seasoned veteran in this Delhi side. And like you rightly pointed out, you know, I think his performance has been amongst the top performances by any Delhi bowler over the last 2 or 3 IPL seasons.
Exactly. So, well, I'll retain the question I have in my mind for one of our upcoming episodes, potentially. Does he belong in the World Test Championship final squad, even as a mentor or as a consultant? But that'll come later, because the squad has already been announced. All right.
It has been announced.
A quick update. But if you go one step back, if you go to the other game where RCB defended even a lower score, right? So, in this case, you're thinking... RCB, they really struggled throughout on that pitch. But then again, it was at Lucknow. But they probably, again, they could have done well to adjust and get to 135 or something, knowing that that will be give them a good chance.
Mm.
They would feel a bit let down again. So Patidar has undergone surgery today. So you would think Rajat Patidar, who had a breakthrough sort of a season last season, would do well. And he's not available. So then you are thinking outside of those three or four people who will really bat. Suyash Prabhudesai has not done much. Karthik has not had a great year. No. Mahipal Ramroor, no. Lower order, not much. Yeah. So no you one. Think, you know, no. 126, you're going to lose this game, right? Because you would expect somebody
because it's definitely a below par score.
Somebody in the top four to come good. I mean, what they had not going for them in this game, Lucknow, is their captain. If Rahul had made a 30 ball 30 at the top of the order, I think the game was done. This is my thought process, right? We don't give him enough credit.
Yeah, but look at what happened with the previous game against Gujarat Titans, where Rahul did score those, runs, runner ball runs, only to sort of squander that advantage in the last couple of overs.
So I remember what game you're talking of, where I think GT defended 135, right?
Yeah, I mean, they had something like maybe 24 runs to score of the last five or six overs, maybe five overs, and they had 8 wickets in hand, and they lost that game.
So that's a lesson there that, you know, you would expect he would slowly accelerate. He would score at 110, but he would finish closer to 135 strike rate, right? That would finish the game off effectively. Yeah. But in any case, I think if he had played and if he had gotten through to those 30 of 30 or so, he would have given his team a really good chance. Mm. But that was not meant to be. He came out at the end just to hold one end up. He couldn't run really. But to expect Amit Mishra to hit 3 or 4 sixes, I mean, that's a bit beyond.
Just can't. Really. No, you can't. Right. Yeah, too much. And I think the responsibility of scoring those runs lies on guys at the top. You know, your Deepak Hooda, Kunal Pandya, Stoinis, and Nicholas Puran. And I think I mentioned this once. I don't know who I was talking to. But, Nicholas Puran, for all his talent and all his ability to sort of get his team through some really tough patches, he just does not perform consistently enough that you can see him as a like threat. You know that, you know, a cheap score or a low score is just around the corner, and you just have to bowl according to your plans, and, you know, he can't make it through. Having said that, that is, you know, different problem for Lucknow to deal with, because I think they have struggled with consistency for the first half of this season, pretty much just as RCP have. Because, you know, Kohli has been making those runs, but his strike rate is still around 110, 120 in most matches. Faf has been scoring runs as well, but his strike rate hasn't been consistently high enough. And then nobody in that middle order has been putting their hand up and performing on a regular basis. Like, even Maxwell hasn't performed really well in most games, you know, bar the odd match here and there. But nothing else after that. The only other consistent performer that RCB have had is Siraj. And, the way he still continues to take those wickets in the power play overs right at the top.
I think Siraj has been the real standout as far as RCB is concerned. And he's probably comfortably taken them past a couple of tough positions to win them games, right? Mm. That has to be conceded. Now, Mumbai Indians have done well. Now, at least after 8 games, they are back in a position where they have won 4 games. They started really badly. Chennai actually squandered a couple of easy opportunities to win, especially after having made 200 and so on. Dhoni was a little critical in that. He said, we can't give away these sort of games, right? So,
true.
You can see now the table has sort of got a bit more of a
flipped
nature,
a bit,
which is steady. Lucknow Super Giants and Super Kings, they have sort of slid down. Gujarat Titans still retain their top spot thanks to their excellent wins earlier on. Rajasthan Royals are also doing very consistently well, but they also have had a couple of slip-ups. So, you know, between position 2 and 5, all that separates the game is the net run rate, right? So net the next 3 games or 4 games, very, very crucial for everybody playing. So today, even as we are recording, it just started. Right, so the game between LSG and CSK has just started.
Yeah, and LSG is already 27-3.
Oh dear! Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, so it's not a good start at all. So Lucknow has lost Manan, Kyle Mayers, and Krunal Pandey already.
Oh, then Ayush Badoni, Stoinis, and Puran. Then they'll have to do some heavy hitting for themselves.
Yeah. And they have to Chennai... perform some wicked voodoo magic now.
No, I'm just thinking Chennai, right? So playing at Lucknow, I think with the attack that they carry, this is Dhoni magic, more of Dhoni magic, because he has a couple of learning bowlers. So Chahar is back. That is good. But he's not been particularly
consistent. Which is good news for them.
Right? He's not been consistent this season. But Tushar Deshpande, Mahesh Tikshana, and Pathirana, the way they have been sort of shaping up, it's like Chennai invests in people and they get to perform for a longer period, at least. Or they bring sort of veterans and they give them the free hand to play however they want.
Yeah, but right? See, this is Dhoni magic, you know, like you say. Mm. The way that man gets the best out of his team players. Like, who in their wildest dreams would have thought that Ajinkya Rahane will be having the sort of season he's having this year? Nobody would have thought that.
Correct. I mean, the way he's playing, you would even think he might, start putting his name up for the World Cup and the World Test Championship and so on. He's the World Test Championship. For sure,
The last time I saw Rahane play this freely was when he debuted in England in 2011. So, we had that debacle of a 4-test series, which we lost. Then in the 1-day series, Rahane came in as the opener in that 5-match series. And if I'm not mistaken, he probably had the highest run tally in that series amongst all the batters.
That's surprising. He has the game. He's always sort of played more responsibly. But if he cuts loose, he has the game. You can see it, right? So,
correct.
That was good to see if you're a fan that, at least somebody like him, you don't want him to go away quietly and slip into retirement or something. He's blazing away. So, he's putting his best foot forward, right? That's nice.
Yeah.
So, now if we were to take a look at the table, the way things are shaping up, who will be your top four, the knockouts?
I think it's safe to say that Gujarat Titans and Royals are likely to be within the top four. I think Chennai will definitely make it to the top four. And I think Royal Challengers Bangalore will make it to the top four. Because I don't see Lucknow maintaining that streak of wins to remain within the top four. And I just don't think their players are up to the task this year. Because Mohsin Khan played a very important role for them last year, bowling in the power play overs as well. Left arm over the wicket, seam bowler. He's injured this season, so he isn't playing. And I think that has played another role in how...
I think he's back. I think he's back.
Is he?
He's playing this game,
If
I'm not wrong.
Oh, is it? Okay, well, good then.
Yeah. No, but in any case, he was not continuously available. That would have affected their plans. You're absolutely
right. No, he wasn't. Yeah. And again, it's that consistency, like I said, that consistency in the batting performances. You've had one or two standout innings from Nicholas Puran. You've had one or two innings from Kyle Mayers. And pretty much nothing from KL, so to speak. And that's basically it.
Yeah, I mean, Kyle Mayers has been a revelation of sorts. It remains to be seen if
he
can't carry the team by himself, right? So that's clear as well.
No, and that's my point. That's my point. So if you look at Gujarat Titans last year, every match they had somebody put their hand up and perform, and more or less it would be at least two players who would do really well. And that is what sustained them through the early part of the campaign and in the finals as well.
Right.
And I think this time around as well, they're doing something similar. And with the introduction of the impact sub, I think Royals have found out a way how to maximize their batting using Dhruv Jurel in that lower order as a finisher.
Right.
And then basically opt for a bowler when they're fielding. So, I think, and they have got the players to perform as well. So, like, Samsung is doing well. Yashasvi Jaiswal is doing superlatively well this year.
Mm-hmm.
Butler has had a few bad games. But other than that, most other people are doing what they do. Like Ashwin's taking his wickets. Chahal is taking his wickets. Mm-hmm. Trent Bolt's opening spells have not been too bad. So I think they will make it to the final four. And Chennai and RCB will make the two other teams.
I think you're the second
guest. That's
my
feeling.
You're the second guest in a row who said RCB will make it. I'm still having my doubts on that because Mumbai is resurgent. And I have a feeling... Mm. It might not be just Mumbai, but also, somehow LSG may find that additional little bit of kick in the last three or four games where between Krunal Pandya and somebody like Kyle Mayers, and they have a Quinton de Kock sitting on the bench. I don't know what's happening there, but Quinton Nicock is still sitting on the bench. I expected him to fully be included into the 11 because now with KL Rahul out of the way, probably they couldn't get their foreign player ratio sorted out. Naveen will have place, right? So
possible, yeah.
So anyway. Yeah.
No, but then you could use that impact sub rule to make sure that Quinton de Kock is one of your openers, isn't it? And then Naveen Ulhaq can come in as a bowler.
They haven't planned it like this. I think the thing about foreign player coming in is you should have already no more than three players in your 11. You cannot exchange an Indian player for a foreign player.
Okay.
They've ensured that.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. Yeah, I see what you mean now.
Because Pooran, Stoinis and Myers are sort of staple in the 11. Then you are forced to let go of Naveen Ulhaq.
Okay.
Only then.
So
yeah.
So let's do it this way. If you've got Quinton de Kock playing, he's your wicket keeper by choice then over Nicholas Pooran.
Exactly. I was going to say that.
So Pooran can come in bat. Yeah, Pooran can come in bat. He can exit. Naveen Ulhaq can come in and just bowl.
Let's see. Let's see. I mean, they've at least in this game, I think they've blown it because they're already batting, and there would be no point in introducing.
Yeah.
Quinton de Kock into the, I don't know, 7th, 8th over. Unless you're just...
No, that's true.
Because now their middle order...
So, yeah, it's definitely going to be, you know, one of those very tight finishes for that 4th, 3rd spot as well. And, you know, let's not forget that there's other people in that mix. I think Punjab Kings is very close.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they are on the same number of points as the other four. So you've got Royals, Giants, like Lucknow Super Giants, Chennai Super Kings, Bangalore and Punjab that are on 10 points at the moment, and it's just a difference of run rate, to be honest. That's it.
Yeah, let's see. I mean, as I said, the next three or four games, because you're already in the last one third of the tournament, is going to be very crucial, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And of course, before we go away from this topic, right, one small mention. Well, Ashwin completed 300 wickets in T20Is, right? So, an IPL.
In IPL? T20. T20Is?
So, IPL. I said T20Is. That's not right. In IPL. So,
yeah.
Again, kudos. He's continually reinventing, continually trying to, you know, stay there. I think this year, again, same as last year, he's been ridiculously consistent.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
That makes it very nice if you're a captain, like, because he can also bat a bit. I mean, I remember him making some slightly outlandish statements, like, I'm always padded up, whether it's just for show, just to keep the opposition guessing, or for me to actually walk into bat, I'm always padded up. So you also get a little bit of mind games if he's in the 11, so I suppose. Right.
Well, look, you have to have in any top flight sport, you have to have mind games. And it's all about like psychologically outmaneuvering your opponent as well. And these little thing tricks help at times.
Nonetheless, champion performer, and he's been, you know, there or thereabouts. We'll see World Cup here, which way it may fall. All right.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Those were all the things I wanted to mention in this IPL related topic. Now, going on, Andrew Strauss has decided to step down from all ECB roles. And he was basically sort of, you know, he was the chair of the performance cricket committee, right? And he basically had a lot of ties with the people that are currently in the squad. Either they came through his time, or, you know, people that he brought up himself as a, you know, as a somebody with the ECB. Now it looks like he's decided to step back.
Yeah, because he started as a director. Yeah,
now it looks like he has a lot of other interests, he says, and he's decided to step out. Is this like a corporate move, sort of asking him to step away, or do you think he's done it voluntarily?
No, I think he's probably done it voluntarily, because let's not forget, like, and if Andrew Strauss, he was the captain when England crashed out of the 2015 World Cup, right? And then when they started their restructure, they appointed him as director of cricket. And a lot of the decisions that the ECB have taken, you know, whether it was Trevor Bayliss's appointment as coach, emphasizing white ball cricket over red ball cricket, and then, you know, the eventual plan for succession, especially now with Rob Key in that director of cricket role, you know, these are all Andrew Strauss driven decisions, or at least his recommendations. So I think for England to ask him to step away would be a grave mistake. And I think given the fact that Strauss has been in this role for close to 8 years now, you know, with a little hiatus in between.
Right.
And he has a young family as well. You know, he lost his wife recently. He's got two young kids. So obviously, you know, the pressures of the job need to be managed with, you know, his role as a father, a parent. And,
right,
you know, just looking after his kids as well. And, you know, people do get to that stage where they kind of think, the immediate challenge that was facing cricket, for which I was appointed to guide them through, is now sorted out. You know, there are people in the right positions. They can continue the work hereafter. So maybe he thought it was a good time to sort of move away from that role.
Interesting.
But then again, you never know. I mean, with the controversy that, you know, Yorkshire was embroiled in, which ECB sort of had to take some sort of flag for, because they're doing a corporate restructure as such, it could be part of that. You never know.
That's what I thought of. But I mean, he's done a wonderful job in trying and help, you know, structure and set up England for long-term success. They won a 2019 World Cup and a T20 World Cup, right? With him sort of in and around the leadership positions. So that's always good. And now,
absolutely,
with the appointment of Brendan McCullum, they're trying to take Test match cricket also to a next level. So they're sort of in safe hands, I would say, even if he chooses to step away now. So it remains to be seen who'll fill in those positions. But I think at least for the upcoming short period of time, he's ensured the boat is steered in the right direction, right?
Yeah, that's true. I think what I'm more interested in these four people that the ECB has appointed as independent non-executive directors, I think they're called.
I saw that.
There's no clarification. Yeah, there's no clarification as to exactly what their role is. And, you know, at first glance, the impression you get is representation politics, because, you know, there are three women out of four, and one of those is from a sort of a minority ethnic background. And you kind of wonder that, is this something that the ECB are doing proactively to, you know, mitigate the fallout from the Yorkshire's racism row? And you never know. So, yeah, it'll be really interesting to see.
Let's really hope those people, they have, it's a non-executive board member, but still they'll have some say in the way the board is headed. I mean, that's the whole point, I think. So if you choose the right sort of people, their input is already going to make a difference, hopefully.
Exactly. Provided, you know, there is some sort of arrangement to act on that input or take on board those recommendations. Isn't it? Because say, for example, you can, because you can have an independent ombudsman telling you, you know, this is what you need to change, which is kind of binding in a way, because that's an ombudsman. But if you just have somebody who's an observer saying, look, this is what we think, you kind of go, screw you. You're just an observer. Yeah, your feedback is welcome.
You don't know enough.
Thank you for your feedback. We'll take it on board. But you're not obliged to act on that.
I mean, eventually, then it'll come to a review, and it's. I understand. It's a bit of a tough sort of situation. But let's see how they're trying to handle this.
Yeah, because let's not forget that part of these changes were because of the review that they did after the recent Ashes, the 2021 Ashes in Australia. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Andrew Strauss was on that committee to do that review as well. So this could be part of those recommendations.
It, he may have made the recommendation, give me 6 months and I'll be out of here potentially.
Could be.
You know, you don't know that.
Could be.
Right?
Yeah.
Fine. Could be. All right. Well, all in all, at least with the Ashes coming up, I think Broad has already started some verbal fireworks.
Man,
so it remains to be seen.
That guy needs to keep his mouth shut, because one of the statements that he mentioned was, I don't count the 2021 Ashes as a proper series. I'm like, who the hell are you telling this to?
Exactly. After you lost 4-0.
Yeah. That's just rubbish nonsense.
All right. But I'm curious which way it'll pan out. There's an Ashes coming up, right? So those are just mind games you have to start, correct, I think, early. Like how McGrath always says final, right? So that's on par for the course. I'm just waiting. Broad has to shoot his mouth off as well and say something that may or may not appear much worthy in the...
I mean, he should just make a 5-0 prediction in England's favour right now itself.
I think he leaves that to Anderson, right? Between them, they're both capable of inane predictions. Anderson usually stays quiet, but I think he's poked by this guy into saying something equally.
Yeah, I'm sure they collaborate.
On and off the pitch. The last topic is Nepal. I mean, the meteoric rise of Nepal over the last couple. They have now beaten UAE in the ICC men's, you know, Premier Cup final. Basically, it was held in Nepal, but it had quite a lot of teams participating. So if you look at the tournament, they had 10 teams participating, right? So you had Oman, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, Hong Kong, Bahrain, Singapore. So you'll see the who's who of the second tier of Asian
Absolutely.
Teams right here. So, but when you look at Nepal, right, if you look at the latest ICC ODI rankings, so they have actually leapfrogged the likes of Netherlands. They're now 14th.
Mm. Does that make you feel bad?
You have a steady top 10. Yes, it does. As a Dutch supporter, yes. Because, our team endured a couple of really tough tours. At least one or two times, I thought they let go of opportunities to win games that were in their hands. Right? So, especially, I remember once when Pakistan were touring as well, they couldn't chase 61 of 60 with about six wickets left in hand. Those sort of things will come back, aren't you? And now you're 15th. Also, in the T20 eyes, they're 15th, Netherlands. It's another topic, but you would expect Nepal are 17th. They are making rapid strides also in T20s, right? So, but they had to win 11 out of 12 games to qualify.
I know.
For the World Cup, and they did.
Yeah.
2024, right? And then now they have qualified for the Asia Cup. So, incredible run of games. And what should be the self-belief this team has, I wonder?
Phenomenal, isn't it? Like, I think when people talk that there's no such thing as momentum, I mean, yeah, in a cricket game, there's probably no momentum, you know, like the physical concept of momentum. But psychologically, you can't define how good it makes you feel, how positive and confident it makes you feel when you have won that many games on the trot. I mean, Nepal was actually facing absolute elimination from that group. They needed to win 5 or 6 games consecutively to even make it to the last three. And they did that. And it's not like they were beating teams like PNG along the way. They beat Scotland, they beat Namibia, they beat UAE. Mm-hmm. And that last game that they beat UAE was an absolute humdinger of a game. I mean, you know, there was a time where you thought UAE is collapsing. Then some guy comes in from nowhere in that middle order, scores a rapid fire 100 of, I don't know, something like 52, 54 balls. And UAE post a total of 320 something. Nepal then suddenly are 3 wickets down and you think, okay, this is gone, done and dusted. And then, you know, these young guns that they have at the moment, they just come in and basically, you know, just seal that game for Nepal. Nepal then leapfrog Namibia for that third position and just go through. And, you know, you kind of think, well, maybe this is what it is. But then they repeat that again in the ACC Premier Cup as well. So they are very lucky to have these guys like Asif Sheikh and Kushal Bhurtel, you know, in that top order over there, contributing for most of these victories. Now, the other important thing to remember with Nepal is how their board functions and how dysfunctional they are. You know, they are probably challenging the likes of Pakistan and Sri Lanka in that matter as to how destructive they can be for their own cricket team and setup. Despite that, despite the fact that they have had a series of coach changes over the last 2 years, they have managed to pull this out of the hat. So they can be a very good team. They can be a force within Asian cricket and maybe at some stage, even at a more international global level as well. They've got an absolutely passionate fan following in Nepal itself. I mean, those guys are just crazy. So much so that I think now cricket has pretty much replaced football as the national sporting obsession in Nepal.
Interesting. So that's a very interesting point you've just made, that cricket has taken over indeed as the biggest, let's say, the draw
right now. Yeah.
And you have all of these people, Rohit Powdal, the new captain, right? You have Sompal Kami, Karan Kesi, some old names, Kushal Malla. And of course, not to forget, he sort of slipped into the background, Sandeep Lamichane. So all of these people are there and the bowling attack is really tough to, you know, score a lot of runs against.
I know.
So I think we will really have a stellar ACC Cup this year with Nepal.
Oh, sounds exciting. I'm really stoked about this. And if you look at the rise of subcontinental teams, I think there is always this rub-on effect because of the presence of teams like Pakistan, India, Sri Lanka over there. You look at Bangladesh's rise in the last 12 months as well and how consistent they have become, not just at, they're pretty much strong at home. they almost gave India a run for their money in the recent series. And then they had that victory in New Zealand earlier this year. So that goes to show how well Bangladesh are now performing. So rather than relying on one or two players that they have traditionally done, suddenly they've got four or five players to bank on as well. And I think that's the same story with Nepal as well. So whereas earlier it was just Paras Khadka, and then later on it was the guys of Gyanendra Malla or Sandeep Lamichhani to shore up the batting and take responsibility for the bowling. Now they've got these four or five players who are just performing consistently.
We really hope, you know, they also are able to make some big hits and make some big impact in the ACC Cup. Like, it's pretty much the story of Afghanistan
massively,
all over, but very, very encouraging if you are Asian Cricket Council.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, I just can't wait to see what the main draw of this competition looks like, because there will be some really exciting games that will be there. I just hope regional politics doesn't get in the way and everybody gets to play the tournament as... you know, as we expect.
Yep. So it depends. I mean, there are some interesting political ramifications between whether, you know, Pakistan will tour India for this, or if it did, Pakistan will play each other in a neutral location and so on. So those things apart, there is plenty to look forward to if you're a fan of Asian cricket.
And see, in my experience, invariably, these issues have always been solved in the boardrooms and the political offices a few days before the tournament starts. And everything then suddenly, you know, gets mobilized very quickly as if nothing has happened.
That's what we expect as well, coming into the last last couple of weeks, maybe heading into the Asia Cup. But just an update, LSG versus CSK. LSG are now 52 for 5 at the end of 12 hours.
That's it. Their goose is cooked now. I think Chennai will win this. How easily they win, that's a different matter.
No, that's the thing. I don't think even if they come to 125 or something, they'll be able to defend it against Chennai. Let's see, right?
You never know. See, it's at Lucknow, and again, these pitches will be slow. And but I think Lucknow have the players to sort of pace that innings very well. Not Lucknow, Chennai. Indeed. Chennai have the players to pace it very well. Yeah.
And see, people like Rayudu, and even with Moeen Ali, Shivam Dubey and Rahane sort of hitting really well, Rayudu's usually been the impact sub. He's not had much of a chance. He'll be raring to go as well to try to get the job done.
And then you've got Devon Conway as well.
All right. Those are all the topics we wanted to talk in today's episode. Thank you very much. I wish all our listeners a good day, wherever they may be listening from, and a good day to you as well.
Thank you, Ajit, and thanks for having me on the show. And it's been a pleasure, as usual, discussing anything cricket with you.
Perfect. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.